Obituary.
Anne Innes Dagg, the Canadian zoologist who devoted her life to giraffes, died on April 1st, aged 91.
When the bizarre creature first appeared in Florence in 1487 at the court of the Medici, it caused a sensation. Bending down its long, long neck, it took food from children and was fed with fruit by noblewomen from second-story windows. In 1827, in Paris, a female giraffe presented to Charles X stirred an outbreak of giraffe mania, with high-piled hairstyles, giraffe-spotted wallpaper, and years on, some say, the design of the Eiffel Tower. What happened to Anne Innes Dagg when she was two and visiting the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago was just as momentous in its way. Being very small, and the giraffes very tall, she was naturally amazed. But when something suddenly frightened them, and they galloped with a flurry of necks and legs across their enclosure, that was beautiful. From then on, their lives were hers. Her toys were giraffes, her drawings were of giraffes, and she resolved to know everything about them. But information was scarce, and not only in her native Toronto. It seemed she would have to write the necessary books herself. At university, she read biology, then taught zoology to get as close as she could. And her devotion never wavered. When she went back to the Brookfield Zoo as a young woman, the stare of a lordly male with huge brown eyes reduced her to reverence. In her 80s, when a male called Buddy bowed low to slobber gently on her shirt, she embraced him. Zoos were not good enough, of course. Why study a set of giraffe incisors rather than watch how they were used to strip leaves from thorn trees in the wild? Why pore over a leg bone rather than follow the way live legs leapt through a thicket? Their movements, so graceful with such bulk to shift, intrigued her particularly. Out in the low veldt of southern Africa, she could watch whole crowds in motion, like a ballet. So she must go. Even Ian Dagg, the man she planned to marry, would have to wait until she had kept long company with wild giraffes. But in the 1950s, young women did not do solo fieldwork. It was improper, or the snakes were too dangerous, or some nonsense. 13 African governments turned her down, and the kind farmer who eventually welcomed her, Alexander Matthew, did so only after she had written masquerading as a man. When she reached his ranch in eastern Transvaal, having walked the last few miles through the bush after her Ford Prefect had broken down, he realized he had a serious researcher on his hands. As for her, she was in heaven. The first wild giraffe she saw exceeded expectations, half kneeling to drink for seconds from a waterhole, before swinging up her head and rising, magnificent. Day after happy day, she was up at 5 a.m. to drive out and observe for 10 hours from her car. Any closer, and the giraffes would have cantered away, but Mr. Matthew had lent her his field glasses and his 16mm cine camera. As for snakes and biting ants and drunken men trying it on, she could well look out for herself. As before, it was the gait of giraffes that transfixed her. They ran so smoothly, she discovered, because the two left or right legs moved in unison to prevent the hind leg hitting the front one. More exciting still, their necks moved in one close correlation with their legs, giving that wonderful flow effect. But everything was done with delicate adaptability to the arid land they lived in. Some aspects of their lives surprised her. They did not form a close-knit herd. They had no leader and, save females with their young, no nuclear families, but were a loose set of individuals who communicated sparingly. Her African hosts thought them stupid, but they were clever enough to jump fences rather than break through and to drink from cattle troughs, which was easier. The most curious thing was how the males behaved. They sparred so much that their skulls had extra deposits of bone, yet it would usually end lovingly, often with attempts to mate. Homosexual behaviour in animals became another study, but she still felt too embarrassed to tell her host about it. She might drive hundreds of miles alone and wear men's slacks, but to most people she met she was a girl, even in her 20s, innocent of such things. She was presumed innocent or uncaring about apartheid, too. She tried to befriend the black ranch workers, only to be told by the whites not to bother. They were illiterate, thieving and clumsy. Her angry riposts were met with laughter at how naive she was. She left Africa after a year with two burning ambitions: to write up and teach everything she had learned about giraffes, and to fight inequality when she found it. Where she now found it, infuriatingly, was in her own life. Marriage was fine in itself, once she had paid for the ring to dispel any notion that Ian had bought her. It became a problem because wives and mothers were meant to be only that. The papers she had produced while cooking and pushing prams counted for nothing. Academia was now not her place. All the Canadian universities where she sought tenure, Guelph, Wilfrid Laurier and Waterloo, rejected her for less qualified men. Like the Romans, who were bothered that the giraffe Caesar brought home was two things, not one, hence camelopardis, camel leopard, they viewed her as a freak. The first full-length scientific study of her favourite creature, the giraffe, its biology, behaviour and ecology, 1976, was therefore written when she was unemployed. Many other studies and papers followed. She found lesser university posts, but without tenure she remained, she felt, a non-person. It took a zookeeper's conference in 2010 and a film, The Woman Who Loved Giraffes, 2018, to restore her to general notice. Guelph apologised, which was nice, but she mourned the wasted years. Making the film took her back to Africa. There she watched her beloved giraffes running free again. No, they didn't stick together like a herd, not at least in the way dominant male humans did at the top of universities in the bad old days.